Thank you for listening to the serialized podcast version of The Mark of a Druid, a fiction fantasy novel written and read by Rhonda R. Carpenter. I suggest that you start the story at the beginning, and to be sure that you get all of the episodes, go to themarkofadruid.com or rhondacarpenter.com. Episode 12, Chapter 18, The Making of a Man, Part 2. Adam inched his way closer toward the edge of the water. Adulsata, the goddess of the river, will be the one to decide if the pair shall live or die, the council intoned. It seemed to be a warning to the other boys not to interfere. But Fagin cannot carry the weight for both of them. The goddess will decide, the council intoned in unison again, firmly. Adam knew better than to dispute the decision. He watched with sadness as it took longer and longer for the last pair's head to surface. In the moonlight, Adam saw Fagin struggling to keep his head above the water, while Dahl's head lulled from side to side. Adam counted the moments between Fagin's breaths. He found himself holding his own breath. Without warning, they surfaced and floated downstream. Adam and Carmag were the first to sprint along the bank. The partners waded out to catch them as they drifted closer to the edge of the river. The boys were cold and limp to the touch. Carmag cut them apart and carried Dahl's body from the icy waters. Adam took Fagin from the river that had claimed this young man's life. The lives of two innocents, Adam said as he lifted an eyebrow and untied the remnants of the ropes from Fagin's elbows. His head lulled toward Adam. Water spilled from Fagin's mouth as if it had been poured from a large vessel. Adam placed his hand on Fagin's chest. There was a beating. Before Adam knew what he was saying, the commands flew from his mouth. Carmag, help me flip him over now. Batar, clear his airway. Adam's old friend did not move. Lorsen, then make sure there's nothing in his mouth. Adam kneeled over Fagin and pushed him onto his back. More water exited his mouth and nose. He made a choking sound. Adam pressed again. Fagin coughed and shuddered, expelling the river from his lungs. The boy was very weak, barely able to push himself to his side. He was disoriented, but he was alive. Adam smiled. Batar, gather some branches we can use to build a litter. We will need to carry Dahl and Fagin. I do not think he will be able to walk back. Lorsen, will you pull some green vines from the trees and strip them of their leaves so that we can lash the branches together? Carmag, will you tend to Dahl's body? Batar looked put out. You are no one to order me about. Adam's tone was unyielding. Move now. The entire test is about working together. Move now! Batar huffed off into the forest. When he returned, he had done as Adam had commanded. The branches to construct two litters were laid into formation, and the vines Lorsen had gathered were tied about each branch, securing them into place. Fagin was more lucid, but still unable to walk. He was wan and continued to cough the slime from the river from his chest. With the mists of early morning dawning on the horizon, the boys carried Dahl and Fagin back to the village. The council formed up behind the litters and sang the song of the dead. The boys' voices joined in with the council's as they called to Arwen, the god of the underworld, to come and claim the dead boy's spirit. The wail of Dahl's mother could be heard across the compound. Adam knew the shrill sounds of grief would stay with him for the rest of his life. However long my life is to be, he thought. Fagin showed great courage as even in his weakness he joined the other boys. Partnerless, Fagin gravitated toward Carmag and Adam, separating himself from Batar. Arthfel called the boys to the central fire and imparted the next task. His voice was rhythmically resonant as he spoke. You will now experience the remaining elements. You have all felt the rhythm of the earth, witnessed the power of water, and succeeded in working as one. The council began to sing the praises of Dahl once more as his mother collapsed in her despair. The old druid's eyes were alight. In the beginning, there were only these. Rock, fire, water, earth. Air, sun, moon, stars, trees, and the essence of all, awaiting in the other world to be born. Stand on the rocks before you, and you shall be reborn of fire. Arthfiel's hand swept a wide circle in the air, gesturing the boys to take their positions around the fire. Each soon-to-be man stepped forward, standing on one of the five boulders that had been placed at even distances around the fire. The stone that Dahl would have stood upon had been removed as if it were known that one boy would not return from the river. As the council sang, Arthfiel approached each candidate from behind, sprinkling liquid at each boy's feet. Adam knew the smell. It was some form of fermented grain. Facing the center, the young men waited for what seemed to be an eternity. The heat of the blaze had not quite warmed any of the young men enough so that their teeth would stop chattering. Ewen, a visiting bard, set each boy ablaze, while the other council members doused the central fire. The flames were terrifying at first. Adam silently prayed to Belenos, invoking the god's protection from that which was his domain, fire, before he realized that the fire was burning away very rapidly. Adam stood very still, his arms loosely hanging at his side. Fagin swayed on his stone, precariously teetering back and forth. To Adam's surprise, Fagin did not fall. Carmag held his place, as did Lorsen, both with a stoic pride that could be seen in the steady gaze of their eyes. Batar, however, did not. He lifted his feet, one after the other, losing his balance, and soon fell from his position. This was a grave mistake for him. He tried in vain to remount his stone. Terror flashed in Batar's eyes. The council encircled him, each member in turn swinging a yew branch at his legs. The whipping sound was deafening as they lashed at his flesh, and the muffled moans from Batar made Adam feel pity for his old friend. Adam knew the damage a carved branch of yew could cause to the flesh. These would be scars Batar would carry to his grave. As the slashing stopped, the wind howled, as did Batar. Arthiel pounded his staff on the ground, then raised it to the sky and pointed to the sun. All eyes followed his movements as he summoned the goddess of the moon, Arianhud, mother of the night, silver disk of light. Bless the passing of these boys to men. Rain down on them fertility and wisdom. Give them strength and courage in battle. Show yourself. The silvery black disk slowly passed over the face of the rising sun. The sky began to gray. Adam held his gaze on the pulsating, haloed disk in the heavens. Could the moon goddess truly swallow the sun whole? A fine mist settled around the central gathering place. It moved over Adam's skin as if it had fingers. Within a few moments, it was dark as night. He could see no more than a few feet around him. The council had doused the fire, creating additional billowing clouds of gray smoke which drifted overhead. They continued to sing in a low, haunting chant that almost drowned out the whimpering sounds coming from Batar's direction. Without the benefit of clear vision, Adam's other senses became stronger. He could hear a great clamoring of men. The sound of metal against metal grew louder. Who is coming? He wondered. The noise was now so near that Adam feared he would be trampled, but held his place, not knowing whether the trial was over or not. A hand touched his shoulder, and the face of his father was nose to nose with him. Arthfiel's voice rang out. Welcome the next phase of your lives. Come and greet it like men. Adam's father embraced him, then stood back wordlessly. As quickly as the sun had been extinguished, it was rekindled. The council members took their places, one to the front and one to the back of each new man. Adam was led home and told to sit. He imagined the others were taken in the same way. Now, what am I to expect? It had been more than a full rotation of the sun since he had slept, and fatigue was showing in his posture. He slumped on the bench. He considered resting his eyes for just a short time, but before his eyes could close, Arthfiel entered the lodge, and with him he carried a bowl of opaque black liquid, which he set on the table to the right of Adam. The leather pouch the old druid untied and rolled open with a flourish was filled with his instruments for tattooing. The young man stared wide-eyed at the glinting metal points that showed brightly inside the leather pouch. Arthfiel gathered his supplies while Adam sat immobile. Each was held in place by two straps of hide. They would not move when the case was closed, which Adam knew would not happen for a very long time. The marking of the skin was a long and painful process. It could take hours, and it was critical that he hold still. It could only benefit him to remain silent as well. Adam braced himself, choosing first to breathe deeply and then to mentally ask for courage and strength. Taking Adam's right hand, Arthfiel stretched the skin taut, holding it in place. The young man had witnessed this process many times during his training, but never had he seen anyone receive the marks on the backs of the hands. It had not occurred to Adam that he would be receiving the marks, let alone in such a place of honor. To receive the marks on the backs of the hands signified leadership. What? Or who? Am I to lead? Only the highest-ranking druids, or the most skilled warriors, carry these types of marks. After several hours of the process, the backs of his hands were bleeding and raw. Adam had flinched only once during the hours of continuous stabbing to his left hand, feeling the small metal shaft touch bone, and the muscle beneath it was excruciating. The pain made it difficult to hold still, and Adam had been well trained and placed himself in the highest state of awareness that teetered on the brink of transformation. He could not bring himself to look at what symbols he had received. The newly made man envisioned the red-haired girl from the standing stone circle. He focused his attention on her image, her walk, her fair, smooth skin, and refused to let that vision go. Arthfiel finished his work. The old druid applied fish oil to the tops of both hands. Then he placed the leaves of the yarrow tree into the bed of the grinding stones, so that he could soften the skins and release their healing properties. The dark green of the crushed leaves was placed on his hands to cover the tattoos. Spider webs were wrapped around the healing leaves with oil to keep them in place. The webs allowed the air to circulate the wounds. Pleased with the bandages, Arthfiel nodded his head, then stood waving to the doorway. It was dark outside. The daylight had been so bright when Adam entered the lodge and was now gone, and stars glimmered in the sky. The silhouette of a woman entered. The flames of the fire flickered in the lodge. The flame's warm glow played in the white blonde hair only partially concealed behind the hood of her brat. A mischievous sparkle passed through the deep blue of her eyes. Even in the darkened room, Adam could plainly see he did not recognize her. He was intrigued. He allowed his eyes to travel over her. Arthfiel waved her closer, then turned to his charge, nodding back to her. "Your father has brought you a gift. You will celebrate your last phase of your man-making with Leanne." The old druid turned and left. Before Adam could stand, Leanne moved behind him. The bitter, sweet smell of lavender filled the room as the door closed with a squeak. She was perfumed. Not many of the women Adam had ever been around had taken the time to lavish themselves with sweet smells, laying her hands on either side of his neck. Her touch raised goose flesh that covered his skin from head to toe. As she massaged his neck and shoulders, he yielded the tension of the last 2 days, meticulously kneading his muscles between her thumb and fingertips. She hummed a soothing tempo. Adam allowed his eyes to close for a moment while he enjoyed her touch. As he felt her move closer, he held his breath, and ever so softly she whispered in his ear, "Adam, a man ye shall be tonight." He rose to his feet and faced her. She threw back the hood of her brat and released the leather thong at her neck. The bright orange of her cape slipped from her shoulders and then to the floor, leaving her pale, slim body standing naked before the young man. She was so clean. Her skin gleamed in the warm glow of the fire. He could feel his cheeks flush as she took his hands in hers, guided him to the sleeping rack against the wall. That night, and the next day, he spent in her arms, exploring every crevice of her body, as she did the same with him. She taught him amazing things in that time. She teased and brought them both to the brink of explosion, then would suddenly pull back. He learned how to take his time coupling. He relished discovering how to pleasure a woman by gently kissing her body. She showed him things he would never have imagined could have taken place between a man and a woman. When she was done teaching, they enjoyed each other as equals until there was nothing left to give. Adam forgot about the world outside of the lodge. He forgot about his training. He forgot about the old druid. He forgot about his father. He wished that tomorrow would never come. Ryerson's eyes flew open as he realized that this was the type of dream that left the sheets moist and sticky. "Well, Roy," he said to himself, "you haven't had a wet dream in years." Still breathing hard, he made his way to the shower to rinse the remnants of the dream from his body, and the smile didn't leave his face for an instant. Chapter 19. Walking in a Field of Clover. Andrea didn't notice Eve when she stood from recording the regression. All she could think was she needed more air. The room closed in around her. She felt trapped. Her body demanded freedom, fresh, clean air, and the sun on her face, the wind in her hair. She stepped into her shoes and took her coat under her arm. "Andrea, where are you going? Are you all right?" Eve asked, setting the papers on the nightstand. Looking at her friend, Andrea took in a long breath. "Eve, I need to think. I'm going for a walk. This experience needs to, I need to sit with it. Alone. I promise, I'll be back before long." Andrea didn't give Eve a chance to stop her or question her motives. She turned and walked out the door, closing it gently behind her. Making her way down the front steps of the hotel, Andrea could see the afternoon sun pouring through the arched veranda at the foot of the steps. She had no idea what time it was or how long she'd been hypnotized. It seemed to her that several days had passed, and each of them had been filled with worry and fear. The experience weighed heavily on her mind. As she reached the bottom of the steps, new guests made their way past her. She took little notice until she heard her name. "Andrea McMurray, is that you?" a voice said. Andrea looked up, startled. "Yes, it is." Andrea's eyes met the face of her client. "Hi, Patricia. What in the world are you doing here?" Then Andrea saw the reason, carrying the suitcases behind Patricia. He was tall, dark, and well-groomed. Dropping the handle of the rolling suitcase he dragged behind him, R.J. Rolfing bent to retrieve the handle. With a huge smile on her face, Patricia said, "We decided to take a couple of days and have a second honeymoon. R.J. has been in Wales on business." There was a seductive giggle behind her smile. Andrea was pleased to see that R.J., Patricia's husband, had stepped away from his corporate commitments long enough to spend some time with her. Andrea smiled and nodded a greeting to R.J., who stood behind his wife. "I was just going for a walk," Andrea said. "Well, we'll see you around, I'm sure. This is really a small place." Patricia walked up the steps. R.J. clearly enjoyed the sight of her derriere. He grinned. "I'm sure we will, Patricia. Have fun, you two," Andrea said with a backhanded wave and a grin on her own face. Andrea walked on. She rounded the corner of Crescent Street and headed for the wooded area some way down the road. Andrea stepped up her pace. The wind caught her hair and it whipped into her eyes. The sun was low in the sky, and the bay sparkled against the pinks and oranges of its setting. A glint coming off the water looked like millions of tiny goldfish churning in the bay among the gentle waves. It was starting to get chilly, so Andrea slipped on her jacket as she jogged past the yacht club. Andrea found the building interesting, and thinking of the structure kept her mind in the moment. It looked more like a big white lighthouse with royal blue trim. The top of the tower was a domed peak, clad in shiny brass. The weather vane sat stoically at its crest. It was a picturesque sight. And Andrea thought about what a shame it was she didn't have her camera. When she jogged past the circular casino building, the seagulls swooped overhead and effortlessly hovered in the early evening breeze. Andrea breathed the salt air into her lungs as if she would never be allowed the privilege again, and increased her pace. Running always made her feel better. Rubber soles slapped at the pavement in rhythm with her heartbeat. Andrea put one foot in front of the other, faster and faster, competing in an internal challenge that neither shoe could truly win. She passed a kayak rental and private beach club. Andrea rounded the curve in the road and pounded up a low hill, which led into a more secluded area. She passed a stone wall that looked as if it had been there since ancient times. Creeping out from among the stone's cracks were clumps of clover and thick moss. The years of damp weather had left a green hue on the stones. An oversized, thick wooden door stood closed against intrusion. How she wished she could step behind it and lock out the dread that threatened at the back of her mind. Andrea's heart pounded its steady beat within her chest and drummed in her ears. She chanted in time with it, "I am Andrea McMurray. I am Andrea McMurray. I am Andrea McMurray." The farther up the road she ran, the more liberated she felt. The adrenaline pumped through her body and saturated her muscles. The fresh air filled her lungs, and all of it helped clear her mind. She restricted her thoughts to the beauty surrounding her. As she rounded the next bend, Andrea took a sudden breath. The sight before her was perhaps the most beautiful she'd ever seen. A lush field of green clover dotted with dazzling bright yellow flowers lay before her. Willow trees with their branches draping to the ground swayed in the breeze, and low bushes lined the clover field. Scattered eucalyptus trees dotted the scene. Carefully, Andrea walked into the field, her breath slowing with each step. When she reached the center of the field, she turned a full circle, relishing the simple beauty of the place. She collapsed into the clover. The deep blue of the sky was scattered with early evening stars that flickered like fireflies. Wisps of thin white clouds dotted the sky. while oranges and pinks kissed at the horizon. It was as if the hand of Monet himself had painted this masterpiece just for her. And it was more than that. There was a feeling, no, a physical sensation of being where she belonged. Andrea had never felt like she was home until now. Subconsciously, she knew it was not the location per se. It was something to do with a field of clover, the greens and the bright flowers. Maybe it was the way the setting sun sparkled off each bright yellow petal, giving the appearance of a moving field of gold. Andrea lay there, allowing her mind to drift. She closed her eyes, taking in the sounds of the trees and earth. The insects buzzing and rustling in the leaves and the treetops was truly music to her ears. The singing of the birds called for the moon, then echoed among the gentle, crashing ocean waves, lapping against the shore in the distance. Andrea slipped into trance. A young girl of 12 winters walked through the field of freshly bloomed clover. The spring flowers were bright yellow and white. Athene kneeled, asking for permission before she plucked them. Soon, she had a lovely small bouquet in her hands. Alian was still in training, and Athene had already finished for the day. The sound of voices coming from the direction of the nearby river drew the young girl's attention. As she approached the trees that separated her from the water, she could make out the sound of boys' voices and wondered who was there. There were no more than 10 boys in the village. Athene peeked through the trees. She saw Davith, Gilno, and Perig swimming at the river's edge. She remembered what Alian had told her of being alone with a group of boys and turned to leave. She had only taken a few steps when a poorly placed foot caused a twig to snap loudly. She turned. They got out of the water and headed in her direction. Gilno waved and called her name from the shore. Athene waved back, then turned to leave once more. She had made it only the length of a small tree before Davith caught up with her. His dripping shoulder-length hair hung in his face. He had not bothered to put on a stitch of clothing. He pulled at Athene's smock and knocked the flowers out of her hand. Athene screamed at him, but he laughed at her. He pushed her as she stepped backwards. Fear rose in Athene's chest. Perig ran up from behind him. They both began to tease the young girl, touching her shoulders and poking at her. "What's under the smock, Athene? Will you let us see? I've shown you mine. Where is Alian?" Davith sneered through a laugh that didn't quite make it out of his throat. Gilno's voice was loud behind him, even as he shimmied into his clothes.
"Davith, leave her be. She's far too young for your games."
Davith's reply was quick and curt. "They're never too young to learn. That's what my da says." The sneer on his face sent a wave of panic down Athene's spine. She was definitely in the wrong place. She turned and ran, but froze momentarily. Davith was older than she by 3 seasons, and had no intention of letting her go that easily. Athene knew from years of watching them that Perig would do whatever Davith said. Her heart raced. She only wanted to leave. The tiny voice in her head screamed, but her lips could not move.
"Stop it!"
Gilno's deep tenor voice was closer, but Athene dare not take her eyes off Davith or Perig to see where he was. Before Gilno could reach them, Davith had Athene on the ground, and Perig was holding her hands over her head. She fought with all of her strength, but she was no match for the 15-year-old boys. As Davith pulled up her smock, his rough hands groped her body. Perig crushed her wrists into the ground as he bent over her, his face touching hers. She struggled. He mockingly made kissing noises at her as she screamed and squirmed, trying to free herself. A scream exploded from her throat. She caught sight of a foot connecting with Perig's jaw. Gilno's well-placed heel had knocked Perig off of her. Gilno landed on top of Perig. His fist pummeled her attacker's chest and face. Gilno punched over and over. She could see from the corner of her eye that Perig hit back, and then her attention was fully on Davith again. He held her arms and pushed her legs apart with his knees as she kicked and tried to free herself. His matted hair dripped in her face. He was so heavy. He thrust inside of her. A pain shot through her whole body as her skin tore. She cried out for help, but he placed his hand over her mouth and nose, cutting off her air. He pushed and pushed himself inside her, tearing and ripping her apart. He laughed and groaned, arching his body, and then collapsed on top of her, freeing Athene's hands. She dug her nails into his face. From right eye to jaw, she drew blood and flesh beneath her nails. Jerking away, he struck her across the face with the back of his hand. Tears streamed down her cheeks. Bile rose in her throat. She could say nothing. Numbness covered her like a blanket. She felt as if her body were no longer her own. Gilno kicked Davith, clipping him in the shoulders. He lost his balance, and Davith hit the ground. But before he could get up, Gilno had him by the throat. He squeezed the squirming maggot's gullet. Athene trembled, one thought screaming in her mind. Kill him! Send him to the underworld! Davith's body went limp. When Gilno released his neck, he rushed to Athene. She screamed and tried to move away, clutching her tattered smock to her breast. Athene, I'll not harm you, please. Let me take you home. That lip's bleeding. Here, let me... The rest of his words were lost on her as he dabbed at her lip with the hem of his shirt. Her eyes locked onto the sprawled bodies of Davith and Perrig. They looked like they were dead. She wished they were dead. She wished she were dead. A deep, burning throb pulsed between her legs. She tried to stand, but found her trembling limbs would not support her weight. Athene's knees buckled, and she fell backward. Supported by Gilno, she swayed toward the ground. The young savior helped her to her feet and steadied her by placing his arm around her quivering shoulders. She gagged. Athene choked on the contents of her stomach. The bitter taste of bile filled her mouth. She spat in the direction of her attackers. Her shoulders convulsed and heaved. She could not stop the weeping. Fear and shame ravaged her mind. The tears burned her eyes as she buried her face in Gilno's chest. Athene, come with me now, before they wake up. Not to worry, I have you, lass. She was consumed with disbelief and sobbed uncontrollably into his chest as he held her tighter. Athene muttered, Why would they do this? Gilno did not answer. He simply urged her forward, gently holding her close. He guided her to the lodge at the edge of the grove. Without a word, he looked down on this shattered beauty and shook his head. He whispered into her hair, Athene, I'm so sorry. Had I been faster or stronger, you would not be hurt. I could not stop them both. A single tear caught at the corner of his eye. His head bowed, his shoulders slumped. They should be punished, and so should I. I was not man enough to protect you. In that moment, the shame Athene felt was compounded. This boy really cared about her, and the guilt showed in Gilno's eyes. Athene felt his sense of failure. He asked her, Will you be all right? Are you hurt bad? What can I do? Through shuddered sobs, the words came, Please, Gilno, tell no one. Not even Alian must know. His mouth dropped open as he tried to speak, but she cut him off, saying, Please, I want no one to know of this. It is the greatest dishonor. If my father were to find out, oh, my father, he would think me ruined or worse. Her voice trailed off into a whisper. He nodded a reluctant agreement. He released her. Athene straightened her back and limped down the path that led to the dwelling she shared with her sister, Alian. And Abjila. Athene hoped that they would not be there yet. When she pulled the leather strap on the planked door, the hinges gave a loud squeak and she flinched at the sound. Wide-eyed, she scanned the room to be sure she was alone. Abjila and Alian had not returned yet. The place seemed darker than usual somehow. Odd shapes lingered in the empty shadows. Athene found her home held only things that were not alive. She wanted to be one of them. The thatched ceiling was covered with soot. like the thick layer of remorse that covered her heart. Athene's mind was muddled and slow as a deep fear began to settle around her. How will I explain the cut on my lip? How long will I bleed from between my legs? How am I going to hide that? I have to think of a way. No one can know. Not ever. She cleaned the blood from her bruised thighs with shaking hands. After changing her tattered smock, Athene glanced at the bloodied rags and ran to the refuse. Determined to free herself of the memory, she knew without a doubt she would never again be able to wear these garments. Tossing them in, Athene stirred the embers with a long stick. The fabric caught fire, and she watched it burn as she backed up to the rain barrel. When she was sure there would be nothing left to find in the ashes, Athene hovered over the barrel. The reflection in the water clearly showed a large mark on her cheek from Davith's slap. Her eyes were puffy from crying, and her lip was split and swollen. Athene ruthlessly scrubbed at her face and went inside. Lying on her straw bedding, she pulled the covers over her head and tried to sleep. It was not long until Alian and Abjila came in, talking about the coming feast of Beltane. Athene pretended to be asleep. Alian shushed Abjila and walked to her bedside. She listened and found her sister's breathing was erratic. Alian gently shook Athene by the shoulder. "Athene, are you unwell? Tell me what's wrong." "My head hurts. I want to sleep." She offered her sister some tea that would help the headache, but Athene refused, pulling the cover over the top of her head. "No, I just want to sleep." Without a fight, Alian slipped away, whispering to Abjila, and began making the evening meal. Athene never did sleep that night. Each time she closed her eyes, Davith and Perrig were there, holding her down, laughing, touching. Andrea's eyes opened, and the dark sky above her told her she was no longer in Athene's world. Pushing herself to a sitting position in the field of clover, Andrea cried. By the time she started back to the hotel, it was fully dark. The stars lit up the sky while the small street lamps did the same for the path she walked. She could not believe what had just happened. She was not sure whether to tell Eve or not. She decided that she would make up her mind when she returned. Slowly walking back, Andrea felt the same feelings of shame sweep over her that Athene had experienced. All Andrea knew for sure was that she desperately wanted a shower and to scrub this rape from her body. Thanks so much for joining me for this episode of The Mark of a Druid, and stop back again. Pick up the next episode at rhondacarpenter.com or themarkofadruid.com. So until next time, thanks and take care.